This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. You can join our conversation about the news of the week on WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. You can call us at 860-275-7266. And the cameras of CTN are here this week, and we'll be on CTN, I'm sure, a lot over the course of the next couple days. I want to welcome back Colin McEnroe. As always, he's the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hello there, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Also with us is Liz Karantowicz, who is a Republican political analyst. Hello there, Liz.
Good morning, John.
And Kevin Rennie, he's an attorney. He's a Hartford Current columnist, and he blogs at dailyructions.com. Hello there, Kevin.
Good morning, John.
Well, we brought in Kevin and Liz specifically because we want to talk about last weekend's Republican Party convention at Foxwoods Casino, which provided a lot of excitement, but not as much excitement as we heard yesterday as Ned Lamont and Susan Bicewicz got together to form a ticket. Ned Lamont, of course, the front runner for the Democratic nomination. Here he is taking some press questions on the street in New Haven about why they're coming together just a few days before the Democratic convention.
No, it wasn't about sitting around talking delegate counts. It's talking about can we work together as a team? And how do we get this state moving again? We, Susan and I both were focused on issues, focused on our shared values, where we want to go. And that's why we're together.
So that's Ned Lamont's explanation of why they got together, Colin. Does that sound right to you as far as why they probably got together?
No. First of all, you may represent the last time anybody uses the word excitement in connection with the Bicewicz-Lamont or Lamont-Bicewicz ticket. No, I mean, obviously, there were – and I don't know what Ned was thinking about, but Susan Bicewicz was thinking about delegate counts and money. And I don't know her delegate count, but typically you don't make a deal like this if you got a strong delegate position. We do know that she did not have an adequate amount of money at this point to qualify for the Citizens Election Program as a gubernatorial candidate. That probably also drove her decision to do this. You know, and I have to say, it's I mean, I thought about this a long time. I tried not to have an instantaneous reaction because people who – the closer you are to politics – the more this bothers you because you have certain ideas about Susan Bicewicz and who she's been in the past and what she's done. I don't know what this – I think it's hard to say that the average Democratic voter who's going to vote in the primary necessarily has all that baggage with him or her. And so from a – I just want to say from a certain point of view, you can look at this and say, well, it's kind of the year of the woman. You know, it wouldn't look good for them to have crowded – a reasonably well-known woman candidate out. There's also this kind of theory that Susan Bicewicz's bad reputation, this has been advanced on this show by Daniela Altomare, that Susan pays a higher price for her aggressiveness and arm-twisting and self-seeking than male candidates do. So there's
a not unreasonable thing to say.
Yeah. So there's sort of all that argument. But it does look like a very – you know, this is the first decision Ned Lamont has really made as a candidate. And it's a very expedient one. He basically took the piece off the table that – or the game board that he was going to cause him the most trouble as opposed to making some kind of visionary, interesting choice.
I think it was an interesting opportunity. I think this might be – this might round out Susan Bicewicz's ballot hopping, does it not? I mean, at this point, has she run for pretty much every office on the ballot that's available? So, you know, she's
not
like
treasurer.
It's like bingo.
Treasurer and controller. Treasurer and controller.
All right, sorry. Okay, so we've hit everything but two. There's still time, you know, this rounds out that ballot bingo. You know, I think – they clearly decided as a party they wanted to get together and start running a general election campaign sooner rather than later, which is completely understandable when you're sort of upside down on the generic ballot the way that they are and when you're looking at the fact that over 73% of the people in the state think we're going down the wrong track. So they've got a lot of work ahead of them. But they're going to have to do some work in the urban areas and in turning out the vote in the cities and in getting people bought into their ticket. Because I think that, you know, what was interesting to me was that there were no Democrats running for lieutenant governor. I know we heard of a few folks, including somebody I went to high school with, Gwendolyn Hall Thames, and was it Gary Holder Winfield?
Gary Winfield.
Who were thinking about it. You know, so from a Northwest Catholic perspective, you know, Gwendolyn would have been a good option for them. But, you know, I think it was interesting that they didn't have anybody running to be on the team. And I don't know if that says more about the people who are running for governor than it does about the people who are running, who were not running for lieutenant governor, you know, if nobody wanted to be on their team. So.
Kevin, what do you think about this pairing at the top
well,
for
I think
the Democrats?
Ned Lamont didn't want to pay for a primary. He is funding his own campaign, and if he could save a couple of million dollars by putting Susan Bisewitz on as his lieutenant governor, you know, for people who have fortunes, these are the sorts of decisions that they have to make. And Ned Lamont is a self-funding, very wealthy Greenwich guy, and I suspect that money's on their minds a lot. And this was a chance to save a couple million dollars. I don't think she would have primaried. I think she was going to be humiliated at the convention, and then it would have been harder for her to reach the $250,000 threshold. But this is her ninth statewide campaign in 20 years. It's really
Bingo.
Remarkable, and it's just remarkable how ossified our political system is, particularly the Democrats, right at this moment. But this reaching into the boneyard is not the way forward.
Into the boneyard, Colin? A lot of people, you and I have talked about this off air quite a bit. We who observe this sort of thing may say, well, boy, she sure has run for an awful lot of offices over time. Boy, she had that humiliation of not really being able to be the attorney general as she was running for attorney general. She's had bad runs for statewide office before. That having been said, there are an awful lot of people in Connecticut, Democrats, who really like her, and they think that she is going to do something good for the state. And probably there's some people who don't think that about Ned Lamont because he hasn't run anything or hasn't been in politics for long enough. And so Susan Bisewitz actually helps the Democratic ticket. I mean, there are those people out there.
Yeah, if running mates help tickets. Right. And so, I mean, first of all, we should maybe contrast this to some other decisions that have been made in the past. So in the case of Dan Malloy, he picked Nancy Wyman because she was more popular than he was. And she was particularly more popular with the base, with the insiders, with labor, with all the people that you need to talk to in the first round, basically, of conversations.
And all these years later, she still is more popular.
She's actually quite a bit more popular than he is now. She pretty much stayed the same. He dropped. But so, you know, typically you might do something like that. Susan Bisewitz isn't really quite the same kind of thing. In fact, it's almost the opposite. She's not very popular with the inner ring, with the first conversation people. She might, as you suggest, be more popular with people who just kind of know her in a general way. They may not remember, for example, that at the end of the 2010 elections, you know, I mean, she really took a medium-sized problem in Bridgeport and blew it up into this kind of massive electoral crisis that was attracting national attention, and then kind of ran away from it and, you know, didn't want to answer questions about it, and, you know, was at one point kind of declaring victory for Dan Malloy but prematurely. And, you know, there were sort of things like that, and the database she was keeping inside the Secretary of State's office that appeared to merge.
Shake hands, bows.
Right. Merge political information with government information. There's sort of things like that that are not great, you know. They're not, but I don't know what they mean to the average person. I don't know what they mean to the average Democratic voter. Just one quick thing I want to say, you know, lieutenant governors don't win you elections. And although I think we need to talk a little bit more about the issues of diversity and representation on the tickets, the reality is, if you had Gary, are you looking at your watch as I'm talking to you?
No. I was getting a tweet notification.
Okay. If Gary Winfield were on the ticket.
Which said you were talking to me.
Yeah, exactly. He's talking to a lot. So if Gary Winfield were on the ticket, I don't know. I think you guys would agree with me. It'd be worth like 300 votes or something. I mean, Democrats spend a lot of time trying to figure out how to turn out urban African-American votes. And they do a lot of strategies. And most of them don't work. I mean, the things that work are named Barack Obama, Jesse Jackson, and Bobby Kennedy.
I think we're sort of discounting here is the Joe Ghanem factor. And right. What does that do? I mean, you know, with everything, the dynamics of the primary, it looks like Joe Ghanem is going to force a primary. He's going to go get the signatures. He's well on his way to do that. He's out raising money the old-fashioned way. Who knows how much money he'll need. But he can sort of, you know, get in there and kind of cause some mayhem if he wants to. Certainly, the votes that he brings from Bridgeport, whether it's in a convention, can be influential. And the votes that he could bring in a primary, but really in a general, are what's at play here. And so to what extent is Joe Ghanem able to build sort of an urban coalition between Bridgeport, Waterbury, New Haven, Hartford? And how does that impact not just their primary process, but their general election prospects, which is to your point, Colin,
Kevin, you were not, shaking your head before when Colin was talking about how many votes Gary Winfield might bring to the ticket. I mean, is there something Democrats should be thinking more about in terms of diversity on the ticket?
Yesterday there was talk of the unhappiness about the mayonnaise ticket at the head of the ballot, and
just made Liz almost spit out her water there.
That was how it was being characterized.
And I don't disagree with that. I think at the level of symbolism, I think at the level of the story you're telling about yourself to the people, it is important not to have a mayonnaise ticket. I'm just saying in terms of just actual votes, its importance is exaggerated.
Let's go back. In 1998, for instance, Denise Napier ran a very smart primary campaign. And this is what we're seeing. This is what we're going to may face this year, is that there is no primary at the top of the ticket. So you have these under-ticket people struggling to get voters to participate in a Democratic primary. And, I think there is an advantage to candidates who are from cities in those instances, because it's just easier to you have the machinery, the mechanisms to turn people out. And if Gary Winfield were to primary Susan Bisowitz for lieutenant governor, he would have an advantage in at least going in.
I wouldn't. Although I don't know, how does he primary anybody? He doesn't have a CEP account. He doesn't have any.
Well,
delegates.
You have to start.
You just have to start.
The convention Saturday.
Yes, yeah, I know.
Don't forget, he could go out and get signatures. But, and if he were to partner up with someone, like Joe Ganim, they could.
She doesn't have a CEP account. Either now. She has one.
She's got to go back to neutral and start over.
She's not going to have, if there's no primary, she won't have a campaign. Hers will be folded into the Lamont campaign that she was so distressed was not participating in public financing.
But if she has a primary, she's in a little bit of trouble.
Yes.
You read the Connecticut Mirror this morning, Mark Pazniokas writes about this, about the unusual rules, the way that, of course, you're not actually a ticket until after the primary. And so Susan Bisowitz's money that she's raised so far in this campaign doesn't really do her much good as a lieutenant governor candidate.
Don't get me wrong. To Aaron Stewart.
Yeah. I would love to see Gary Winfield primary. I think that would be a very interesting primary. But I think if he really wanted to be lieutenant governor, he should have been thinking about this in maybe like January.
Well, right.
Well, why Susan Bisowitz yesterday is fine.
Well, because she's been running statewide.
But Gary Winfield today is not.
She's been running statewide for a while. She's established herself. Yeah. She's tried to
she's
raise money.
For
she's
20
been,
years.
She's been a supporting delegate. You know? I mean, really, I would love to see. Really, I think that would be a great primary. But I do think that, 3 days before the convention to say, oh, by the way, I've been thinking for a long time that I might run for lieutenant governor. Well, why didn't you?
Does it go more to the fact that the Democrats have not looked at this as a team approach? Did they just sort of want to wait and see and hedge their bets as to what they were going to do? And this was sort of the plan all along. Let's let, somebody go along and run. And then, I mean, the fact that nobody wanted to join Ned Lamont's team, nobody wanted to join Luke Bronin's team, nobody wanted to join Susan Bisowitz's team, right? I mean, no one was running for lieutenant governor as a Democrat because there was nothing inspiring them at the top of the ticket.
On the Republican side, you get three people running for lieutenant governor who aren't inspired by the top of the ticket. They're running for lieutenant
governor.
They
want to be on a team.
Did you have a thought, Kevin?
I had a thought that this is not just the Democrats, although it turned out to be that way this year, is that the lieutenant governor's spot is used as a reward for a candidate who will say, please don't believe anything I've been saying for the past year. And I'm going to sail into this safe harbor.
In this case, I think that's the case. The thing this reminds me the most of is Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush.
Yeah.
I mean, after George H.W. Bush had said many, many damaging and unkind things about Ronald Reagan, keep your enemies closer. So that's what they did. And I think there's a little bit of that. The one thing that we do know, based on previous experience, is that if Susan Bisowitz had run a primary, if she'd been able to raise the money and get the delegates or whatever it took to do it, signatures or whatever, she would have run very, very tough, bordering on vicious attack ads on Ned Lamont that he probably also was not looking forward to.
Well, that goes to Kevin's point about expenditures and not wanting to spend a tremendous amount of money.
We're going to take a break. We're going to try to figure out what's going on with our microphones because there's something happening. When we come back, we're going to go through what's happening on the Republican side. Their convention this past weekend, very different story there. We could have six or seven people on the ballot. We're also going to be talking about the Oz Griebel factor. No, that's not a show on CTN. It's actually the possibility that Oz Griebel might be draining votes from some of these candidates. We're talking with Colin McEnroe from Connecticut Public Radio, Kevin Rennie from DailyRuxions.com and the Hartford Current, and our Republican political analyst, Liz Karanowitz. We'll be right back in the Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking about the week's news, and there's a lot of political news this week. At WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse, also on Facebook and Twitter, at WNPR Wheelhouse. You can join us, 860-275-7266. We're talking with Liz Karanowitz, who is a Republican political analyst, Kevin Rennie, who's an attorney, a Hartford Current columnist, and he blogs at DailyRuxions.com, and also our own Colin McEnroe. Hey, Colin, what's on your show today?
Well, actually, you said to me one time years ago after Jill Sobule, the musician, came on our show, you never heard anybody sort of figure out the show so fast. She's funny. She's spontaneous. She's also just a terrific songwriter and singer. So we got her to come back to the studio. She's in town to perform at the Mark Twain House. So
yeah,
she'll
she's
be
doing
with us.
A cool thing like in the library of the Mark Twain House.
Yeah. So we'll be talking about that, and she'll
awesome.
Be here causing trouble.
That will be a lot of fun. So that's
will
the call.
Will she perform?
Oh, yeah. On this show? Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, she'll have her guitar. Yeah.
She's going to be performing, and you'll hear it all at 1 o'clock on the Colin McEnroe Show this afternoon. So, as promised, we're going to spend this segment talking about the GOP convention, where gubernatorial candidate Mark Boughton garnered the endorsement on the third ballot, but not without rivals Tim Herbst and Steve Obsitnik, reaching the 15% threshold needed for an automatic primary. Here are Boughton, Herbst, and Obsitnik in that order speaking after the final results were announced.
I just want to thank all of you for coming out here. And whether you voted for me or not, I'm going to earn your vote.
And I look forward to making a very clear contrast with the other Republicans that are running for this office.
There's been steady progress behind what my message has been for Connecticut. I think it's time to go down a new path.
Okay, so those are three of the candidates, Colin, we'll talk about. There are more who will probably end up on the primary ballot. But you were there. You spent the day there. Good for you, by the way. I'm glad somebody did it. Liz was there as
nice
well.
To see
Liz did it.
Yeah.
We had a good time.
It was fun.
What do you make of these three emerging in the way that they did on the third ballot for Mark Boughton?
Well, I mean, in many respects, a lot of the decisions that we talked about in the first segment, the decision to, as Liz said, for the Democrats to kind of get unified and just start their general election campaign, were conditioned heavily by what they saw happening in Foxwoods, which is there's a very crowded field. We don't even know how crowded a field it is. We're not even exactly sure.
It could double.
I mean, it really could.
It really truly could double.
Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of people with petitions and stuff like that. And I don't know, one very prominent Republican turned to me and said, I don't think the nominee of the party is in this room right now. So it's a much more volatile, mercurial kind of situation. Now, you know, that's not necessarily a bad thing, you know, particularly when you're running against what somebody called a sclerotic Democratic ticket. I mean, if something bubbles up, somebody bubbles up who's exciting and dynamic and, or at least interesting with some different ideas, that could really work to their advantage.
Kevin, you looked like you were going to jump in.
Well, I think that some of these candidates are going to find out or be reminded how difficult it is to get on the ballot through collecting signatures.
Hard.
It is, and people, you know, the Connecticut, and I say this all the time, and I'm not going to stop. The Connecticut political system here in the Constitution State puts up ridiculous obstacles to ballot access for candidates.
The barriers to entry are intended to protect the sanctity of the of the party process, right? I mean, that's where the thresholds come in. You know, so for listeners who don't know, in order to gain access to the ballot for a primary, which is what you require to gain access for a party nomination for the general election, you have to obtain 15% of the delegates at the party's nominating convention in order to be an endorsed candidate and or to pursue a primary. So in our convention, in order to win and get the endorsement, you have to get 50% plus one of the delegates in attendance.
That's 50.
Yep. To gain access to the primary ballot, you must receive 15% of the delegates at the convention.
On any one ballot,
correct. And then if you are unable to do that, you then have to go out and collect signatures from 2% of the registered partisans.
If you're unable to do it, or as some of these candidates have chosen, they just decided we're not going to take part in that process
at
all.
Which meant that they were unable to do it.
Also,
because it's far less.
If you roll doubles, you have to go three spaces back.
And you don't collect $200. Yeah. So, you know, the process in and of itself for us, that equates to roughly 9,400 signatures from registered Republicans. There's a buffer that you need to have because the Secretary of State's office is going to kick out somewhere between, you know, what, 30%-ish?
Probably not 30%, but
it depends.
Enough that you're going to – you probably should get to 11,000.
I would err on the side of probably closer to like 13. Yeah. But the reality is you have to go out and find those – you're not going to get this going to the supermarket, right? I mean, you have to go find Republicans and you have to constantly be in people's face asking for signatures. It is a very – onerous, expensive, and detailed process. So the barriers are there to prevent people from just sort of, you know, going around the party.
So there's state party rules. There's state rules. I guess I'm wondering, Kevin, does this help the party? We're talking about the Republican Party here. Get to the best possible result. I mean, this kind of crazy show.
They think it does.
Really?
They think that essentially having unchallenged control over the nominating process is best for the party, and they would say best for the state. I think that it just discourages people from it keeps people from having choices. It discourages a lot of candidates. You know, there are candidates who've – I think Mike Handler, who didn't do very well at the convention, he has taken out petitions, but he's never going to be able to – I think he's not going to.
Yes, I think
collect.
He said he wasn't going to pursue those petition
to.
Signatures.
David Walker, who was quite full of himself, and he fell very far short at the convention. He's not taking out petitions. I think, you know, yesterday in Pennsylvania there was a primary. I believe they have a direct primary system. Are they somehow poorer for it? I don't think so. I think
Colorado has
fine.
A similar system. You have to go out and collect signatures, or you can go the convention route to get to the primary. So it's similar, but it's a high barrier to entry. And frankly, when I was executive director of the party in 2010, we didn't have as many candidates running for governor, but we did have a very, you know, thorough conversation about the cost of the convention, both financial, but also in sort of this, you know, infighting. I mean, you know, it's not helpful. What the Democrats have done has given them an advantage in the general election because they're not going, in all likelihood, to spend the next 3 or 4 months bloodying each other up trying to win the party's endorsement.
Hey, Colin, did you have a thought on this? Because I want to take a call here on somebody who did emerge from this with a little bit of a shine, I suppose.
All right. So, well, very quickly, I mean, the numbers are even bigger on the Democratic side, obviously, because it's based on registration. So they need 14,000-15,000. That's what Ganim and Guy Smith, the two people who are going to do this on that side. And to Kevin and Liz's point, that means you really need 18,000-19,000. So that's a lot. And they also, I think they still all have to be, you can't just stand there with one clipboard because everybody's got to sign
right.
on the town. You got to collect the signature.
You need 169 pages when you're standing there.
169 clipboards or pages or whatever. It's so complicated. So who really can work this probably are people who have big war chests that can hire companies that go out and do this. So Stemmerman and Stefanowski, these two guys who are relatively well-heeled, who didn't really participate in the convention but are going to do signature campaigns, I don't think they and their, you know, families are going to be outside ShopRite. I think they're going to hire companies to go do this.
I've, a few years ago, I helped a local candidate collect signatures to get on the primary ballot. I was astounded at how much work it was.
And that was for a local race?
A local race, yeah. Yep, which she won convincingly.
Yeah.
But
well,
to get
course,
on the
Kevin,
primary ballot,
you'd expect nothing less.
I was surprised how many people didn't know how they were registered.
Well,
we're convinced of how they were registered right. and we're wrong. And
we've seen that wrong. Become an issue.
Well,
Jovis Kani is in Israel right now for some reason, but like somebody should hire him. I mean, he seems to know how to do these things.
I want to go to a phone call here because Ryan wants to talk about one candidate who did come out of the convention with that 15%. Hey there, Ryan.
Yeah, hi guys. I thought it was obviously big news that Bowen got the endorsement, but I think the big story was Steve Sitnik getting into the primary. And I read an article in the Connecticut Post by Dan Haar. I thought it was really interesting what Sitnik did. He had people wearing different hats across the convention floor. just a few of his top advisors, and they were directing him where to go. So I think he's a really smart guy. I think he's really got a good chance. I encourage you to read his book, Run to the Fire. He's got a great story, a Navy veteran, went to Wharton, and he's worked on Silicon Valley. So I think he was the big story of the convention.
Hey, Ryan, thank you very much for that. And you, I mean...
Well, gaining ballot access
well,
is
the campaign is everywhere.
Is important.
I would say
is
we know that
we will. We sort of get back to neutral here, right? I mean, now that the only advantage really in winning the convention endorsement is that you get top ballot access. So Mark Boughton, which is from a statistical standpoint, usually worth 3 to 5 points. In a primary, and depending getting that top line. So there's an advantage there. Otherwise, I think everybody sort of starts at zero, and they're going to have to go out and make their case to the primary voters.
I think the deferential nature of many Republican primary voters is helpful to the endorsed candidate.
Yes. And, we have a it's their turn sort of approach
turn
to things.
But I do think your caller of suspicious origins is correct.
I'm sure he's unaffiliated and just very enthusiastic about Mr. Obsitnik.
He's the one person who read Dan Har's piece and also Steve Obsitnik's book.
Danny Har wrote a very nice piece.
I do think he's right. There was I believe that if they'd gone to a fourth ballot, mm-hmm. and if the
that would have been brutal.
That almost anything could have happened.
Just the voice vote alone to close the balloting was brutal. This was probably peak political junkie when they called to close the balloting, and there was they said all the ayes and all the nays, and you couldn't tell the difference between the two, and so they ended up having to kick out all the guests and non-delegates. And they did it again, and then they finally had everybody stand up if they wanted to close the ballot. It was really dramatic.
Let me just say one thing about the Obsitnik. Well, a couple of things about the Obsitnik phenomenon. First of all, he was the story of the convention in a lot of ways. He overperformed expectations. He had a great floor strategy. Ben Proto and Dick Foley and people like that were working for him. They did a great job for a guy who's not really all that well known. I think also, let's call this the Danny Har syndrome, since Danny's already on the table. So the press is always looking for somebody who's not the same old, and who's going to talk about ideas and policies as opposed to just rolling out kind of stale-sounding, anodyne, political sound bites. And so a guy like Obsitnik is very attractive, particularly to Danny. That's what Danny's looking for in particular in life. He wants to find somebody with some really interesting ideas who can talk about substance to him. And so Obsitnik is going to be very attractive to the press. And maybe he'll be attractive to the public. I have no idea. But sometimes we deceive ourselves. I call this the Bruce Babbitt phenomenon. Was it 88 that Bruce Babbitt ran? The press loved Bruce Babbitt. Nobody else loved Bruce Babbitt. Right. We're just hungry for people who don't talk the way everybody else talks and who think a little bit before they talk.
Well, that's sort of what Ned Lamont benefited from in 2006.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're looking for someone who doesn't look like everyone else, who maybe has some different ideas coming from a different place, why just no love whatsoever for Aaron Stewart at the convention, it seems, Liz? So we had Aaron Stewart, not anymore running for governor. She's not getting support for lieutenant governor. She said when asked by the press that, really the idea of having two white men at the top of a Republican ticket probably isn't the best look for the party. What happened with Aaron Stewart?
Well, on that particular point, I'm not somebody as a woman. I'm not somebody that thinks we need to be sort of checking boxes. I do think we need to put the best candidates forward that are going to do the best job for our state. And so I'm not a box checker. I think women in leadership is incredibly important, and they should get there on their merits and on their electability and in the support that they get. So I'm going to disagree on that piece of it. But I think that there was for Aaron, it was a difficult spot. It's anytime you're out there, and clearly she was trying very hard to take the notion away from people that she was really running for lieutenant governor, and she jumped through great hoops to do that, to really present herself as the gubernatorial candidate. But I think her runway was just too short. And I think the runway for the lieutenant governor's race in the convention was too short. Given how short that runway was, I think she did well. But for folks, Jamie Stevenson had been working that for quite some time in terms of getting out there and talking to delegates, doing the meetings and having those conversations. And clearly Joe Markley is well known, had been in the Senate, been in the House. He's been around. He ran for chairman. So he's somebody that was well known to those delegates and has been working it very hard. And so in these convention fights, it really is about, you know, making the ask and getting in there in front of people and having that conversation. So I just think she had too short of a runway to get this done.
But can I just push you on that box checking piece of it, though? That one of the things, and this is, I think, happens with both Democrats and Republicans in the state. We don't have a whole lot of diversity at the top of the ticket. We know that. But look, both parties, by and large, are run by kind of well-known or reasonably well-known white men.
Well, I'll remind you that the only woman leader in the building is Themis Claridis.
Well,
she's a Republican.
And she's a Republican. But my point is that Ehrenstorf just doesn't have to work really hard and, you know, come up through the ranks. She's got decades and decades and decades of mountains of obstacles put in her way.
Jody Rell was the lieutenant. White men who
run the party and who run the other party,
I completely disagree with that.
Really?
Jody Rell was the lieutenant governor who became the governor. We have more women in the House Republican caucus than there are in Paul Ryan's caucus in Washington, D.C.
But I'm talking about getting to the top of the ticket as Ehrenstorf
coming at Hillary Clinton against Barack Obama.
But you have to make that choice. Yeah, if Erin had started the campaign earlier, I don't know that her issues would be this. I think this is a runway issue. I don't think this is a Erin Stewart is a woman issue. I completely reject that notion.
Mm. Kevin, did you have more thoughts on that? I mean,
Erin Stewart has benefited from a unusual amount of favorable attention in the media, I think because she's a young Republican woman who won a big victory and then to become mayor of New Britain and then won two re-elections.
And she's got a great story to tell.
If she does, she didn't tell it. And I also think part of the problem is, and I think we've seen this throughout this campaign, is that these candidates for governor have no idea what they're going to do if they they got elected. And she was one of those. She just didn't have any answers.
Well, that is fair. And I think we can say that across a whole lot of them. Colin, did you want to jump in?
I think both parties have problems. I think the Republican Party, notwithstanding the stuff that Liz just said, suffers from a perception that it's a party dominated by white men, and not just in the state of Connecticut, but generally speaking. And the iconography often isn't good. I mean, the widely circulated shot of Mark Boughton surrounded by white guys with their hands raised in the air. It's not a completely true thing, but it's a perception. But I think the Democratic Party has a problem, too. As I said, it's not that this having a representative ticket turns out votes, but it's the story that you tell. And you also have to plan for the future. And as millennial voters come into the marketplace, they're going to expect more diversity. You know, I mean, for millennial voters, African-Americans aren't people who live in the city, but I don't. African-Americans are people that I marry, you know. You're seeing a bunch of younger voters who are going to come into the marketplace. They're not as significant now as they will be. And they are going to expect to see politics reflect the way that they live. And the way that they live is in a much more diverse, integrated way, whether we're talking about men, women, gay, black, Latino.
I just want to point out the Democrats have not had a very good record of nominating and electing women to statewide office in Connecticut. And when Linda McMahon ran for the U.S. Senate in 2010 and 2012, the Republicans were given no credit for nominating a woman for that office.
Really quick, I want to get to a couple of people that we haven't really spent any time talking about here. We talked about the top of the Democratic ticket with Ned Lamont and Susan Bicewicz. What about Mark Boughton emerging from this? He's had these health problems. He, like Susan Bicewicz, has sort of been maybe he hasn't run for 9 different offices, but he's been in the public eye for quite some time. He's run for governor in the past. What do you think about Mark Boughton coming out of this as a strong top of the ticket for the Republican Party?
Well, look, I think he was always the front runner. This was his third approach. He's been running for governor in Connecticut for a long time. He has, you know, been working those delegates and working those people for a long time. He raised his money pretty quickly. He learned from his previous campaigns that he had to get that done and done quickly. So now it's his job, as he said, to go out and convince the, you know, 50% of the people at that convention that didn't vote for him that he's the guy. And so that's his job. And he's going to have to excite a primary base of voters who have to go out and vote for him. I think, again, you know, he gets the benefit of the doubt of being the endorsed candidate, which does help him on the ballot, just specifically on the ballot. Again, you know, as Kevin said, we sort of have this it's his turn approach when in some cases as Republicans. But, you know, he's going to have the same primary campaign that, you know, frankly, that other candidates have had run against him. I mean, our primaries have been our downfall. You know, some of the tactics and look, all is fair in love and politics. Right. I mean, it's a blood sport for a reason. So I hope it doesn't cost us a general election.
All right. Should Republicans be excited about Mark Boughton, Kevin, getting behind their top of the ticket? Or is it a good thing if the party has six or seven people duking it out for this primary?
I don't think it's bad to have a vigorous primary, and I do think that what will be interesting is that Tim Herbst, who came in second in his primary, he would have to fight the kind of war that he likes on many fronts in a crowded primary, and there just aren't resources to do that for someone who's publicly financed.
Therein lies the issue: are the resources right?
And
there.
So, you know, David Stemmerman is going to be able to spend a lot of money. They're each going to have $1.25 million for the others in the program. And, you know, will that ultimately be what costs them a victory?
You know, the convention started with eight gubernatorial candidates. So it's hard to have a lot of enthusiasm for any one candidate when there's eight candidates sitting up there on the board, all of whom have at least some kind of constituency. And so by the end of the convention, I mean, there just wasn't this huge wave of excitement about Mark Boughton. There was a huge wave of excitement about the fact that we weren't going to go to four, five, and six ballots, that some solution provided by Steve Obsitnik, I might add, had been provided to us. So, you know, how that plays out in the general election. I mean, nobody knows until you run, right? I don't know how Mark Boughton is going to run. I'd be surprised. I think he's a very nice guy. I like him as a person. I'd be surprised if he's really galvanizing the electorate. I think he's got a long fight ahead of him to actually secure the nomination.
If Ned Lamont got Susan Bicewitz out of the race, and as you said, Colin, one of the things that he might be worried about is a whole series of nasty attack ads and Susan Bicewitz saying terrible things about him in the primary that would lead to his downfall. Is Tim Herbst that problem for Mark Boughton?
Well, there are in terms of the kinds of campaigns that Tim Herbst is probably likely to run, I mean, it's going to be a snowball with a rock inside it. So there's a bit of a similarity to some of the campaigns that Susan Bicewitz has run. I think the kind of thing that you're talking about is full employment for food tasters, right? I mean, you wind up with Tim Herbst or Susan Bicewitz as your lieutenant governor, you probably shouldn't be the first person to take a bite of the souffle.
I'll tell you what. Let's take a break. We're going to come back. When we start the next segment, we're going to talk a little bit about the Oz-Griebel factor, I promise. And then we're going to talk about the 5th District race, which is turning into an interesting race for Democrats in the state. We're talking with Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show, Liz Karantowicz, our Republican political analyst, Kevin Rennie, an attorney, Hartford Current columnist, and blogger at DailyRuxions.com. We'll be right back after this in The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking about the week's news with Colin McEnroe, Kevin Rennie, and Liz Karantowicz. Talking all politics today because, well, there's an awful lot of statewide politics. We have talked about the Republicans and the Democrats. There was a convention of the Oz-Griebel Party. He's an independent. He's run for statewide office before, and he is going to take on these candidates. I'll start with you, Colin, and just ask if Oz-Griebel, as this moderate Republican, stands a chance to drain some votes away in the general election from either of these tickets that I think it's fair to say we've said aren't generating a ton of enthusiasm here.
Right. And so drain is probably the right word. It's hard for me to imagine a scenario, although there is a scenario where Oz-Griebel wins and becomes governor. It's hard for me to imagine that scenario. It's not hard to imagine him having an impact on the race. One of the differences between presidential politics and gubernatorial politics is there's no electoral college in Connecticut. In 1992, Bill Clinton got, I think, 44% of the vote, but 68.8% of the electoral votes. But, I mean, Ross Perot drained a lot of popular votes away. He didn't get any electoral votes. Oz could really, I mean, people, the people who were unhappy with the deal that was announced yesterday one of the first things they did was start emailing and texting one another inside the Democratic Party going, that's it, I'm voting for Oz. Now, I don't know how many people those are, there are there, but if each of these tickets winds up seeming kind of bland and unexciting, it can only help Oz.
Liz, what do you think?
You know, you have to – I think that barrier for Oz, you know, we've been talking a lot about an ability to raise money and spend money on a campaign, and I think that that really becomes the issue. How much of a campaign can Oz run? Can he raise money? Can he get out and turn out a vote? Can he do all of the sort of tactical and operational things that a campaign needs to do in order to go tell their story? Otherwise, he's going to get the votes from people who are just unhappy with the ballot. And generally speaking, you know, over the course of the last – you know, three or four elections at the statewide gubernatorial level, you know, that amounts to maybe 1 or 2%.
Kevin?
I think it's going nowhere.
Mm.
And when you're running for governor of Connecticut on a platform of no politics, it is clear you have no clue as to what business you are in. Look, politics is simply resolving conflicts, really. And we're going to have plenty of conflicts.
It's resolving conflicts? I guess I don't see that.
Well, it's coming.
I don't know politics resolving anything.
It's a means of one side prevailing over the other in conflicts. But,
okay,
so, but look, we have to come to decisions. So we have to come to decisions. I don't think many people are going to come to the decision that Oz Griebel is the way forward.
It's a throwaway vote unless he's able to raise the money to run a campaign and do what he needs to do to win a general election. It's going to be people who are just not happy with the other candidates.
Well, okay, so here's another.
The freaky thing here is that if one of the wealthy Fairfield County Republicans emerged and got the nomination, November would be vote for the rich white guy of your choice. you know.
But it's not.
The thing I wanted to ask, though, Colin, is if you have an Oz Griebel, one thing that we can talk about is, does he drain votes away? Does he have any realistic chance of winning? Okay, so maybe he drains some votes. Maybe he doesn't have a realistic chance of winning. But in a general election, somebody like Oz Griebel, who's seen as a pragmatist, who is working on solutions for our state's problems sensibly over time, does he force these people to actually start to talk about some of the things that they want to do for the state? I can already see Liz shaking her head. I'm going to ask you.
I think we have to ask ourselves, what kind of election is 2018 going to be? And everybody has a theory, right? It's about Trump. It's about Malloy. It's about something else. The one thing we can probably all agree on is it's not about, well, let's keep things going the way they're going here in Connecticut. All right. So that's what it's not about. It's about change. Something different has to happen here. So, you know, a candidate who can really articulate a specific kind of change and be believable about it, be credible to people to say, yes. You know, I mean, you know, Sanders and Trump did that in 2016. They convinced a whole bunch of people that they would change stuff. The candidate who can do that, and frankly, I don't see that candidate in this particular group, but the candidate who can do that will have a huge advantage.
Liz, why are you shaking your head at me?
I don't think that, you know, there are barriers to entry to get into the conversation. And so in order to be part of the conversation, you have to be part of the campaign. Again, tactically, operationally, you have to be part of the conversation. And I don't see that entry point for Oz at this point unless he really starts to raise money. I love Oz. I've known him a long time. But there are things you have to do in order to become part of the conversation.
He's had the field to him. He sort of had that part of the field to himself for months now. And just hasn't made an impression.
In addition to the statewide races we've been talking about, Republican delegates last weekend endorsed former Meriden Mayor Manny Santos over two other candidates to run for the 5th Congressional District seat that's being vacated by U.S. Representative Elizabeth Esty. Democrats in the 5th District held their own convention on Monday evening. It was a nail-biter for former Simsbury First Selectman Mary Glassman, who beat out political newcomer and former National Teacher of the Year Johanna Hayes. Here's Glassman being interviewed by Fox 61's Katie Corrado afterward.
How did it feel in those last moments when it was so down to the wire?
Oh, like throwing up? Yes, it's tough. But it, you know, it should be tough because this is a high-stakes election. This is a high-stake race for the 5th District and for the country.
And here's Johanna Hayes giving her take on how the convention and last-minute vote switching played out.
First of all, if you support someone and you believe in the work that they're going to do, you're going to support them all the way through. So the game of politics does not work for me. I will not do that.
Kevin, I'll start with you because you just said if you don't want to play the game of politics, I don't know how it's going to work for you.
It's going to be. I do think this practice of switches on your vote a few minutes after you have declared for one candidate and getting up and changing to another candidate diminishes our political system. It's just it is unsavory. And
it's fun. Come on. That's how the deals are made.
This is the real – that's the part, Liz, that I think I and a whole lot of people who watch this just can't stand. It's the how the deals are made. No, it is unsavory. It's not what you do. You go and you support someone and then you support them.
Well, you do until you don't, right? I mean, you have to come to a winner.
It is the inside.
You believe in someone or something.
It is
and then
the
you stick
inside
with that
belly of the beast. This is like the nitty-gritty grassroots politics. And as somebody that has grown up in this over the course of the last, you know, too many years, it's part of the process. It's part of the game. Everybody knows. And it's your job as a campaign. I'm sorry, but you have to be passionate enough.
These are people
enough.
Who are trying to convince us that they're trustworthy. And the one thing they are not is trustworthy.
But you have to go into the game knowing that what you're working with.
We're not in the game. We're the public. We're looking at these people and we're saying they are treacherous. They are untrustworthy. God, I can't imagine what happened.
I'm going to push back on that a little bit and say, look.
Well, we're going to ignore you then.
There's a lot of reasons why people might have switched. First of all, in that situation, there were three candidates. Mm-hmm. Sanchez gave his delegates permission to walk, right? They could go to whoever they wanted to.
Well, he withdrew.
So suddenly you had a whole bunch of delegates who were free to choose somebody else. And so this is how they chose. I think she's a little out of line talking about in her remarks. The other thing is, you know, I believe it was she who insisted that all the candidates give speeches before the ballot. It's also possible
who?
That Johanna Hayes, wasn't she the one who insisted?
I don't think so.
Oh, I think.
No, I believe that was her. And the Glassman people didn't want to do speeches.
Right. So, you know, it could be that somebody heard her speech and thought, you know, I don't like her as much as I thought. You know,
No, that's not what we're talking about.
Yeah.
We're talking about the end of the ballot switches.
Yeah, no, I know the end of the ballot switches. But in other words, people are allowed to have evolving thoughts about this stuff. And certainly once Sanchez—
10 minutes.
Sanchez dumped a bunch of delegates into the pool, I mean, they were going to go other places.
Just practically speaking, if whether you switch or go to another vote, somebody's going to change their mind. So the switch really doesn't matter what the switch does is it avoids just going to another ballot, which is exactly what happened for the Republicans at the end of the third ballot, right? I mean, it just avoids having to go through another ballot.
At the end of the second ballot, they had a winner before the switches.
Mm-hmm.
After the switches, they had a different winner.
Well, then her support is not as strong as she thought.
Or her floor game wasn't that great, too. I mean, people dangled things.
Right.
But if you can't,
something
if you
other
can't win
than
these,
the candidate's merits came into play.
Let me just sort of say this in a different way. One of the problems that you have here is, and I think this is a reasonable scenario, Chris Murphy's people went to Johanna Hayes about 2 weeks ago and said, you should get in. You're the kind of candidate we really need. And I think that's fine. I think that's a good thing to do, to say, yeah, here's this dynamic African-American teacher, and she's not a politician, but let's get her in. Now, 2 weeks before, it would have been great if they did that the day after Elizabeth Esty made her announcement, so she could learn a little bit about this game. She's a little bit like somebody being thrown into an NFL game who's never seen a football game. She doesn't seem to know what happens from play to play, and that's a kind of a temporary, maybe a permanent disadvantage. I think it's really great to go looking for that kind of candidate, this non-traditional candidate who might really energize the base. But you got to prepare her, and 2 weeks is not a lot of time to prepare her.
All that tells me is her support was not as strong as she thought.
She lost by 6 votes. Mm-hmm. She won before they started the switches. She did very well.
I think the thing that Kevin and I are agreeing on here about this is I just wonder, Liz, though, if when people look at politics, all this stuff that we're talking about, that's the game. Whether or not it's all the vote switching and the crazy rules that we talked about, the lack of ballot access, that's the stuff that people can't stand. What they really want is to figure out people who are trustworthy.
Then they should all participate in primaries. They should join parties and they should participate in primaries.
That is absolutely true.
I'm for open primaries. I've advocated for that for a long time in terms of in direct primaries, not open primaries. So I'm for going to a direct primary and having that open conversation. But until then, the game is the game.
Liz Kerenowitz, she's always playing the game. She's our Republican political analyst. Thank you so much, Liz.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for Kevin Rennie coming in. He's a Hartford Current columnist, blogs at dailyructions.com. Thank you, Kevin.
You're welcome.
And thanks to Colin McEnroe, host of the Colin McEnroe Show. Thank you so much, Colin.
Thank you, Mr. Dankowski.
The Wheelhouse is produced by Scott Breedy. Our executive producer is Katie Solarski. Kion Wolf is the technical producer. Thanks to Carlos Mejia, who helps with the show, along with Betsy Kaplan. Continue our conversation, WNPR.org/thewheelhouse.